I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Two mass shootings this weekend took 29 lives in El Paso and Dayton. In Kansas City, guns killed four people in 4 days, including a man at 55th and Prospect and a young woman enjoying the crossroads first Friday. Today, less than a week after taking office, Mayor Quentin Lucas faces one of the priorities of his administration, and that's reducing violence. We'll get his thoughts and the thoughts of others affected by this weekend's shootings. Then, meet the man who lost his sight well into his career as an architect. Rather than leave his chosen field, he incorporated his disability into his work. Learn how that changed his vision for designing and why he thinks cities are perfect for the blind. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Nine dead in Dayton, 20 dead in El Paso. The violence from mass shootings continues across the country, and the death toll continues to climb here in Kansas City. This weekend and past days, four more died in shootings in Kansas City, including Aaron Langhofer, who at 25 was an innocent bystander at 18th and Main when a stray bullet ended her life at First Fridays, an event attended by thousands. The Dayton, Ohio shootings occurred in an entertainment district, too. This city has struggled with violence in Westport, and now it's come to First Fridays. So we wondered about how city leaders plan to move ahead, and if young people in Kansas City are starting to have second thoughts about showing up at big events. Turns out the answer very well may be yes. With us, Kansas City Mayor Quentin Lucas is here. He's vowed to focus on crime with a goal of getting the homicide count below 100. Mayor, always a pleasure to have you here. Thank you.
Good to be with you, Steve.
Taylor Hammersmith is also here. She's 25, works downtown and hangs out with friends in that district. She was a friend of Aaron Langhofer's. Taylor, thanks for taking some time.
Thanks, Steve.
Jeff Owens is also here. He's the vice president of the Crossroads Community Association and chairperson for the association's First Friday's events. Jeff, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
Well, Taylor, I wanted to start with you. You might have been at First Friday's a few nights ago if you didn't have some work to catch up on. I'm wondering how you're feeling now about big events like this and your willingness to head out in public on weekend nights.
Well, first, I'd just like to say to everyone to continue to pray for the,
Oh, sure. It's tough. For Aaron and her family,
for Aaron
you're
and
talking
her family
about.
And, yeah. All of her friends. She was a person with so many friends and was so loved by so many people as, yeah, every victim of gun violence is. So please just continue to pray for her family and for our city and for our community. But yes, I mean, the simple answer is yes. I could have been there. My group of friends was there. They could have gone to get food. There's so many what ifs, and those what ifs can get to you at a certain point. I think there's different levels of impact. There is the level of, you know, gun violence in extremes, mass shootings happening in your community, and it kind of makes you take a step back. And then I think there's gun violence when it's someone you know or when it impacts your friends or your family. That really makes you question what you do, where you go. I know me personally, when things were not looking great in Westport, me personally, I stopped going to Westport as much. I still go, but there are still there are times when, you know, I tell myself I would like to be out of Westport by X time because I don't feel comfortable being there anymore until 2 a.m. or 1 a.m. Part of that is my going out to these kind of places, habits have changed. But I think whenever you experience trauma, you are less likely to go back to that place where the trauma was experienced. So I can only, you know, speak for myself in this point, but I'm probably not going to go back to First Fridays. And I wasn't even there, but just knowing that and seeing the pain that all of my friends are in and the pain that her family is in, I don't want to go back into an experience where one that happened and two that could happen again. And that's, it's going to build to a point where everyone is somehow touched by gun violence, and everyone is going to have that place that they don't want to go back to.
Yeah.
And then the places that people can go are going to be fewer and fewer.
I gather this notion of whether to venture out or not, this is something that your friends are talking about, Taylor. This is a topic of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, quite honestly, right now, I would say a majority of my friends are just grieving, and none of us really can comprehend what is actually happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think we're talking about it right now, but certainly in the past when things have happened in Westport, it has deterred us. I mean, and whether it's an offhanded comment or if it's, you know, no, I don't want to go there. Yes, I think people are talking about it. I mean, even when I was on Twitter yesterday, which that was a terrible, terrible platform to be on, as I think were many other social media platforms, but it is talked about. Whether it's in Kansas City or if it's nationally, you're seeing young people saying, I don't feel comfortable going out anymore. Where do I have to go? If I can't go to a food festival or a music festival or just shopping, where can I go to have fun?
Yeah.
So,
Mayor Lucas, you know, you just heard Taylor speak, and I want to be really sensitive about one point, which is we're talking about First Fridays and what happened here in Kansas City. But there's a portion of our city and our community that deals with this a sense of unease on a daily, hourly, minute-by-minute basis. I don't want that to be lost in this conversation. But I'm wondering what you're thinking about this notion that young people getting skittish about going out to First Fridays here in our community.
You know, I understand where the comment's coming from. I'm going to take a slightly different path because I know that when I moved back to Kansas City at age 25, I moved to the 18th and Vine District. And over the years since, there have been a number of different incidents. I've stayed. I've been fairly safe. That doesn't mean bad things don't happen. But at the same time, I think what we really see as a problem here is 2 points. One, gun violence, generally. Another is people that are acting with impunity in connection with putting people at risk in our community. I was at First Fridays this week. I walked probably the very same path that Ms. Langhofer did and a number of thousands of others. There was a very high police presence. But when you have people that are willing to start firing off one block away from law enforcement, that suggests that there's something kind of deeper. There's something about the fact that people really are trying to solve everything with firearms and that they don't think that there are repercussions in connection with it. And we see that, and we saw that tragically in the crossroads this week, and we saw it in every homicide of my mayoral term, and there have been too many because I've only been in office about 4 days.
I'm just struck by the fact you're saying the shooting occurred a block or even less away from police officers.
Yeah.
What does that say? How do you begin to get your arms around that if the police are right there?
Right. What I'm seeing is that there is an ever-growing, and I don't want to get too philosophical because nobody cares about my thoughts on that, but the value of human life. I mean, there is just this significant question. You know, earlier this morning, I was thinking about another tragic shooting from our city this year, and you may remember, I believe she was a 15-year-old girl killed at Central High School, who, again, school district security, several feet away, they walk outside, there's a fight, people start shooting. To Taylor's point, at your school, at festivals, and anything of that sort. I mean, that to me is the big issue. And I think what we're seeing and some of the frustration is there's this question of where can we be safe? It's not a crossroads problem. It's not an individual district problem. It really is a city problem mixed with certainly firearms, but also in terms of how do we get a lot of these folks who are assailants to recognize that life matters, including their own.
Jeff Owens, you oversee First Fridays for the Crossroads Community Association, and I'm wondering about your thoughts about this incident Friday night and what it might portend for the future.
We've just been in shock over this because we've had 20 years of literally hardly a fight. Over a million people have come there locally and internationally, and it's just been something we wished would never happen, but we knew there was a possibility of it. We'll be having community meetings and letting people voice their feelings, and we'll make some adjustments. we've been working really hard behind the scenes to provide the kind of things we needed for these size crowds we've had over the last couple of years. We've gotten a lot bigger, from 10,000 to, you know, 20 to 30,000 just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So we've been just a moving target and working hard to keep up with what we have going on.
You know, Jeff, you're saying you're going to make some adjustments. What are you talking about? Is the future of First Fridays in any question here?
You know, it's an event been going up for a long time. As a family-friendly event, a big part of Kansas City, and I don't see that it's going to go away. I think we're going to try to make it safer by, you know, potentially shutting it down sooner. There's just several things that we can do to tighten it up a little bit.
Hey, have we reached a point in your own mind, Jeff, about how possible it is? Is it possible to hold family-friendly events on a big scale in Kansas City or anywhere for that matter, given the events of recent days?
The problem is that there, you know, I've been asked this several times since this happened, is it safe to be in Crossroads? And it's just like, are you safe when you walk out the door of your house? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a national problem. It's a Kansas City problem. It's a layered problem. There's no easy fix, but it can be fixed. It's just going to take everybody working together, and starting from everybody when they're a little kid all the way through their life, to create these things that are missing right now. Mm-hmm. The life mentioned, and educating kids that they can get in a fight and not go to deadly force. I mean, there's some holes in a big part of our society right now that need to be filled up.
You know, Mayor, you're not even a week into your term. It's not lost on me at all. And yet the news on the violent crime front is so distressing. 4 killed in the past 4 days in Kansas City. The city now on pace to top the 143 homicides of 2018. That 143 was unusually high number, even for Kansas City. Again, I know you've been asked this a lot lately, but how do you confront it? Where's the city going to go?
First things first, we make sure we don't stop caring about it. We can never let this be regular. You know, the pain that I see from our guest Taylor today is the pain that we see too often in Kansas City, Missouri.
Yeah.
Every week, multiple times a week. And that's, I think, our first resolve. The second needs to be, and this is just a perspective I've taken on this, because, you know, I'm not necessarily having a conversation about what the president will do, or Mitch McConnell, or Nancy Pelosi, for that matter. I'm more interested in what we're going to do in Kansas City to address these sorts of issues. I want to find a way to make sure that we are stopping the ability for some of these young people to get firearms so quickly. That is something we legally can do, right? Mm-hmm. Minors, right, aren't actually supposed to be in possession of firearms without some parental permission.
So that law already exists.
So that's a federal law, but frankly, I think we can beef it up with a municipal ordinance, which I'd like to pursue and starting working on this week. I think we also need to double down our efforts. I've mentioned gun buyback programs. I know there are many criticisms of their ineffectiveness, but frankly, it's too easy to go out and get a gun. This 18-year-old man, I don't know how he got it, but frankly, I don't know if any of us sitting in here know actually where to go get an illegal gun today. Mm-hmm. But I think there are a lot of people right now who do. And I'd like to see us stop that as much as possible, so we don't have these incidents where somebody's running away from a fight and shooting back at a bunch of people.
You know, your predecessor, Sly James, made it part of his ongoing anti-crime effort to talk about getting guns off the streets in Kansas City, made numerous trips to Jefferson City to try to push mm-hmm. some form of gun control legislation. In the wake of the weekend, Mayor, do you see any bend in the gun rights crowd when it comes to perhaps reconsidering some of these laws that arguably might make a difference in Kansas City?
No. No. I mean, and that's why on the campaign trail you likely heard me say things about, look, I didn't run for office to go to Jefferson City and to Washington. We'll let them do their thing. We're going to do ours. I am not interested in constitutional battles about the Second Amendment. I'm interested in saving lives in Kansas City. And so the work I'm going to do every day is in connection with that and making sure we are as safe as possible in our community.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date. This morning, we're talking about the aftermath, the weekend of violence across the country, violence in Kansas City. Your comments welcome at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Michael from Kansas City, Missouri. Michael, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
How's it going this morning?
Good. Thank you for calling, Michael.
I actually grew up in the same neighborhood as our mayor, and proud of you. Good to see you there, sir. Do feel the heavy load of what's going on. I was actually in the crossroads at that particular time. I've been in other areas that were deemed to be as violent or worse than that, and nothing had happened. There was no real police presence or anything like that. There was security. There was a community kind of involvement in that, and I'm wondering, what is it we can do to kind of foster that kind of environment? Because these are the place that I'm speaking of that I was at on a particular First Friday in Kansas City this year that was not violent whatsoever, but would have been perceived to be, and folks would have been scared to death, but would not have been there. How do we kind of foster that particular environment everywhere and save that First Friday's event in Crossroads and spread that all the way down to 18th and Vine, where it should be? Yeah. It should be a citywide event.
Mayor?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are a few different solutions we can have in connection with it. One is, I think, some of the review we're hearing right now from Jeff and the Crossroads group. How do we make sure that there aren't parking lots without activity where fights can build up? How are we making sure that, I know the Streetcar Authority invests in extra security, making sure we're doing that, making sure there's a real presence.
Shutting it down earlier, Jeff also said that possibility is out there.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're doing is creating that greater community activity. And perhaps, limiting the hours that we have the event going. I mean, I think those are all on the table. More to the point, fundamentally, though, we need to make sure that the folks that are making these choices right now to bring a gun to a big public event either don't have that firearm or are deterred from doing so. Because, you know, I don't want to be dramatic. It can be Crossroads this week. It could be the Overland Park Farmers Market for next week. And that's my biggest concern right now.
Jeff Owens, how late does First Friday's run today, and what might an earlier time to cut it off look like?
Well, originally, First Friday was from started at 6 and was over at about 9. And so one of the reasons there was, it's right now, we shut it down at 11 and try to have it completely gone by midnight and open the streets back up.
Mm-hmm.
We've got several streets blocked off.
Might you push that back to 10 o'clock or 9 o'clock?
That's kind of what we're thinking, is 10 o'clock, potentially shutting, having everything shut down at 10 and start closing down, you know, between 9 and 9:30.
Okay. Back to some calls here. Frank from Lawrence. Frank, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. I'd like to remind your listeners and your speakers, a year and a half ago here in Lawrence, Kansas, a young lady from Shawnee who was going to go to Westport, they said, no, it's too dangerous, come to Lawrence. She was here on Saturday night after midnight, big crowd in the street, couple of groups from Topeka fighting. Gunfire broke out. The guy, just as in the final Friday, First Friday, the gunman headed west and firing backwards and unfortunately hit the innocent bystander, Leah Brown. She was killed there. So violence happens anywhere. It just pops up, and I'm afraid there's no way around that. I'll take your comments off the air. Thanks.
Yeah. Anything you want to say to that, Jeff?
Well, that's exactly what our problem is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can do things to make it better. I love the fact that Kansas City could come up with a plan that nobody else has thought about and to really make an impact on this. Kansas City is just too incredible and have too many. It's just such a crazy contrast between all the beautiful things that are going on in Kansas City and this violence. They don't really go together, and I think we need to really work on it.
Joining us now by phone is Missouri State Representative Judy Morgan. She's a Democrat representing the 24th District, which includes the Crossroads in Kansas City and large parts of Midtown. Representative Morgan, nice to have you again. Good morning.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, we're talking this morning about the chilling effect that the mass shooting in Dayton and the one Friday night downtown here in Kansas City could have on, you know, city entertainment districts going forward. I'm wondering what you're hearing and what your concern might be along those lines.
Well, I think I have many of the concerns that all of your guests have. I just talked to a friend the other night who said, you know, her kids are grown now, but she would really worry about them, you know, going to out at night almost. You know, it's like people are fearful, but it's something that we're going to have to fight back against. We don't all want to just stay in our houses. We want to be able to go out and do these things. So I am hoping that the kids, sounds like the mayor and the person from the crossroads, the young lady whose friend was killed, everybody wants to deal with this issue. And we're just going to have to all stick together and work at it, because we don't want to stay cooped up in our houses all day in fear.
Representative, I mentioned earlier that former Mayor James was convinced that the General Assembly had a role to play when it came to reducing gun violence, even here in Kansas City. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. I agree with Mayor James, and Mayor James did everything he could to try to get the legislature to listen, as did, Daryl Forte, who was the Kansas City police chief at the time, Gene Peters Baker, prosecutor, and we still went ahead and passed that bill several years ago that allows permitless carry of concealed weapons, so kids as young as 19 can carry a concealed weapon without getting a permit or completing the 8 hours of firearms training or even going through the background check conducted by the county sheriff. So, yes, I do believe that the legislature is part of the problem in this, that we have actually enacted laws that are making it more difficult, I think, for cities to work on these issues.
Do you expect, in the wake of the news from across the country the past few days, do you expect any response, Judy, from the governor, from the General Assembly, when it comes to gun control kinds of issues?
I'm always hopeful that things will change, but if any indication from the past is true, the Missouri legislature has just, you know, been unwilling to look at good bills. You know, we Democrats have filed bills on universal background checks, you know, establishing extreme orders of protection, safe storage of guns, things like that, that I think really could at least bring, you know, have some help for this issue. But so far, most of those bills, they just language and don't even get sent to committee until the last day of session, when they're required to actually put every bill in a committee. So I don't think that means we should give up. I think we need to keep on working at this, keep on working in the legislature. I think, though, before anything will change, we're going to have to change some of the people who sit in those seats in the Missouri legislature.
Okay, that's State Representative Judy Morgan, again from the 24th District, which includes the crossroads in Kansas City. Representative, thank you for taking some time. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You bet. Bye-bye.
My heart goes out to everyone. Thank you.
Thanks, Judy. Let's go to Richard from the East Side. Richard, you're on up today. Good morning. You there, Richard? Let's go to Max from Midtown. Max, you're on up today.
Hi. So I actually heard about this through my mother from Florida, and I find that my town, my area, Hyde Park, we're desensitized. We had 2 shootings in 2 weeks just a couple of months ago, and I just find that when some people say that, you know, we can't let it desensitize, I told my mother, this is just what happens in Kansas City. So how can we get out of that kind of stasis of that, well, this is just what happens, and really take action and, you know, and feel like we can go out past dark?
You know, that's an excellent point, Max. And Mayor, you alluded to this notion of not becoming numb to the violence. And, you know, a lot of people in town tend to think, I'm just going to be blunt here, that the problem can stay on the east side. As long as that's the case, it's not an issue for me. How do you navigate this when it's a citywide issue?
You know, we tell the stories of the victims, and it's a shame that that there are so many of them. But the murder on Thursday night that has not been discussed that much was a 62-year-old man, an Army veteran, a guy walking down the street, right? Somebody who has so much life around him, people who care, over 32nd in Indiana. And so I think what I need to do as mayor, what we need to do from prosecutors, police, and all others, is to make sure that we're sharing not just the stories of these folks, but the pain and the impact to their families.
Yeah.
And we also need to make sure we're letting people know the focus and the work that we're doing. The woman references incidents in Hyde Park. I reference them at 18th and Vine. We do have folks that are working hard to make sure that those get solved every day. And so what I would say is, and it was part of my campaign, Steve, and you covered it, you know, we do care. My line was not a throwaway of, we can have all the nicest things in the world, a new stadium, all that sort of stuff, downtown. But if these sorts of incidents happen, then we are not the city we need to be. And that's the sort of focus that I think we need from City Hall every day. Frankly, that's what we need from the community as well.
You know, one of the issues that perplexes me, and I can't quite get my arms around it, Mayor, is this notion of why is it that Kansas City and St. Louis are so prone to this question and this issue of gun violence when other communities not far from here, maybe 3, 4, 5 hours, 7 hours away, don't seem to have quite the same problem. What's going on here?
You know, I will say some of it is politics and state politics. I think it was referenced by the representative, but I won't give us that excuse, right? I mean, if you look at Chicago, the south side of Chicago comes up often too, has kind of a similar issue. That city's just so large. The statistics don't seem as stark, although frankly, they're troubling. I do think there's this thing, and it's not as simple as to say poverty. We say that all the time, but the thing I always think of is people were still poor 40 years ago, 50 years ago, right? And there were handguns and pistols around then, and frankly, some liberal and lax laws in certain places. The question is, how have we gotten to the point now where I think people care less, and what can we do to create something different?
Yeah. Back to some calls here, and Richard from the East Side. Richard, thanks for calling back. Good morning.
Steve, it's Richard Tolbert. I have a suggestion for the mayor that comes from the Crossroad experience. We were lucky in the Crossroad experience that those two policemen chased down and caught the bad guys. So often when there's a shooting and a killing, it's a long time before we catch the bad guys. But the solution I would suggest to the mayor's capacity as a member of the police board is hire many more detectives. My observation over the recent years is that these detectives that we have seem to be pretty good at eventually catching the bad guys, but it takes them some time. So I think we should invest more money in detectives so we can catch the people who shoot into a crowd and remove them from society.
You know, one of the issues we've had, Mayor, is this notion that how many detectives we have or not, a lot of people don't feel comfortable sharing information Correct. With the police, whether you're the detective, the greatest detective since Sherlock Holmes, it's a problem.
It's a significant problem. And I think there are two parts. First, I do agree with Mr. Tolbert that we do need to invest in more detectives so we have a better clearance rate. I think right now there are a lot of people who think that if something bad happens, if they're the assailant or if they're victims or know the victims, there won't be anything solved. And that starts to lead us to that other point, which is somebody needs to talk. Too many of these homicide scenes, you can see that there are witnesses around, but everybody's afraid. And I think a part of that is because there's this concern that if we don't actually clear the homicides, then all you're doing is buying concerns for you and your family. So I do want us to also focus on this campaign that is anti this anti-snitching type thing. Mm-hmm. Getting more people to say, we want you to speak. Finding more funding for witness protection services, something that we often don't do. Making sure that we're saying, no, we need you all in the community, all of us, to be part of solving these issues.
Klaus from Platte City. Klaus, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, thank you. I wanted to say it's as laudable and commendable as all efforts are of individual cities to try to stop that. There is no way around it. It is the gun culture and the easy access to guns in this country that make it unique among all Western nations. No other nation comes even close. As long as the population doesn't stand up to this craziness and demands that real changes going forward in the entire country, I'm afraid individual cities, despite all the best efforts, will not have too much success.
Klaus, I appreciate those comments. And Taylor, before we leave, you heard some comments here about the possibility that we're going to shut down First Fridays maybe earlier than we are right now. Jeff was talking about that. Would that help?
It's hard to say right now.
Yeah, right.
It's just too close, frankly. But I will say that personally, I believe in Kansas City. I believe in our mayor. I believe in the people of Kansas City. I believe that we can do better. So I hope, I sincerely hope that one day I will go back, my friends will go back, because, you know, the Aaron that I knew was fighting for people. She cared deeply about people. That showed in everything that she did, whether that was her work, whether that was her friendships, her relationships. So I believe in it. I believe that whatever changes that there are, that they will be made, and that everyone can play a part in making this a better community to live and to live in, and frankly enjoy. I've enjoyed Kansas City. This is certainly not an enjoyable point of having lived here, but I believe that, you know, there is a bright future, and there can be, as long as people are, like the mayor said, not forgetting about this, and two, that people are treating other people as human beings. To me, again, personally, that can be the biggest part of all this. I mean, treat other people as they are your own.
I don't know if there's a good way to wrap up this segment, but that's about as good a way as I think I'm going to find. That was the voice of Taylor Hammersmith. She works downtown. She was a friend of Aaron Langhofer's. Mayor Quentin Lucas was also here. Always appreciate it, Mayor. Jeff Owens, Vice President of the Crossroads Community Association. Good luck with your work. We'll be eager to hear and see what you do.
All right. Thank you,
Thanks
Steve.
Thanks so much. When we come back, we're going to visit with an architect who just happens to be blind. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. I hope you've had a chance to sign up for Up to Date's new newsletter. Go to kcur.org/Kraske to sign up and receive exclusive content from me and the Up to Date team right in your inbox each week. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the show, we'll look at the upcoming Johnson County elections. We'll talk about who's running for Shawnee City Council and who could be the new mayor there. Join us for that conversation tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Chris Downey is an architect who just happens to be blind. Yes, a blind architect. You might wonder how he manages, and so did we. And so did 60 Minutes, which featured him earlier this year. He was 45 when he lost his sight. Things were going well. He was happily married with a 10-year-old son. He coached Little League and rode his bike. But then surgery for a brain tumor left him completely blind. Here's the thing. Things are still going well, very well. In fact, Chris Downey hesitates when asked if he'd take his sight back again if he could. Chris will be in town on Thursday for a fundraiser for the Children's Center for the Visually Impaired, and he joins us now from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, help me here, Chris. You gave a TED Talk back in 2015 in which you made what for me was an absolutely startling statement. You said cities are fantastic places for the blind. Why does that make sense? Because I think of them, and maybe a lot of people do, as something that's just the opposite.
Yeah. Really, the foundation of that response was the idea that in a big city, you have public transit, you have streets with sidewalks, urban core. So it's more of a pedestrian walking environment. And there's just a number of things that if you're blind and visually impaired, you really rely on.
Like, what did you discover about cities that maybe you hadn't really reconciled or recognized during your sighted years, Chris?
Well, it was interesting. I always enjoyed cities and walking in cities and cycling through cities. But in becoming blind and going through the same streets, the same sidewalks, really the quality of that sidewalk, that street experience, when somebody's outside of the car and actually engaging the city, that it's so much, so critical. And that's where so much of social engagement happens and sort of the real sense of the city.
Tell us about the smells of the city, because you've said that different parts of town, and you live out in the Bay Area, have their own distinct smells.
Well, I have to admit to the fact that I also lost all sense of smell. So I speak of that in the general blind experience where people can recognize where they are. And it's sort of the sense of smell for most that are blind can play a really critical role in your orientation as you move around. Since you can't see where you are, you might smell the different locations, and you have it's just like having a visual confirmation of where you are. It could confirm your progress along your route. If you're looking for lunch or a coffee, you could use your sense of smell to help zero in on that, or any other things like a flower shop or whatever else.
You know, you also say, Chris, that you get lots of advice each day as you make your way around town. I'm wondering, what kinds of advice do you get?
Oh, it's funny. It's great on one hand that people really want to help out. Sometimes it can not be that helpful. Sometimes it can be startling. Since you can't see them, you don't know that they're there, and all of a sudden somebody's grabbed your elbow and your shoulder and starts to pull you somewhere. So that can be a little alarming.
Whether you want to go there or not sometimes,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and sometimes they think they know where you want to go, but they may not. And so I've had somebody, often have people very assertively insist on taking me somewhere, only to find out once they leave, then I can ask somebody, and then it's like, oh yeah, okay, I'm in the wrong place now. Yeah. But there's no stopping that individual from insisting they knew where I needed to go.
Well, you had a brain tumor that led to your blindness. Can you describe for us, like, what happened there?
Well, it wasn't actually in the tissue of the brain. It was in the fluid that surrounds the skull. Mm-hmm. Actually, the tumor was located right at the optic nerves. I had been experiencing some visual phenomena, mostly as a consequence of playing baseball with my son and coaching his baseball team. And when he would throw the ball to me, or the kids would, the ball would disappear out of the hands and become a big fuzz ball, and then in the last second become clear right in front of me. So especially when these kids are throwing it, upper 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour, it gets kind of terrifying. And so I had to cut that back, and eventually it got to where I couldn't even see a ball being lobbed into me. And that's when I went in to have my eyes checked. And all I could determine was there are lots of blind spots all over my field of visions. And then it took a while of getting through different specialists to get to a nerve specialist who had an MRI to discover the tumor, that it really completely enveloped the optic nerves, squished them, pushed them out of position, and that's what was causing all the blind spots.
So, Chris, when you woke up from the surgery then, was that the moment you realized you were completely blind?
No, actually, the day after, I could see, and it was fuzzy as expected. I could see color, forms. I really couldn't see faces very well, but that's really what they were preparing me to experience when I came out of surgery. So everything was fine. I was actually moved out of ICU. As the next time I woke up, that about half my sight was gone. I alerted the staff to that. I was rushed back to ICU, and the next time I woke up, that's when it was all gone.
What was that moment like for you?
Well, it was a little odd. I was remarkably calm. I don't know if it's because they had me on good drugs or what. But I also had this sense that, I really trusted the doctors. I was like, okay, they got this. I really didn't worry about it. I was like, okay, they'll figure it out. They'll restore my sight. And I even just like, this sort of thing, I'm a happy-go-lucky, the eternal optimist. I'm like, this sort of thing just doesn't happen to me. It's not going to happen. And so they did their thing working on it for a little over a week until they sort of ran out of options and even out of the box, less than conventional things. And they had exhausted all possibilities. So that's when they told me they couldn't. And so it was basically close to a week and a half later that it, at that moment, that it's like, oh, it did happen to me. And that's when I really first started to deal with it.
You know, maybe some context here helps, because part of your reaction just from reading about you, if I understand right, Chris, was you were just happy to be alive, because your father, you lost him at a young age, and something similar, Chris, or help me there.
Yeah. Let's see. My father was 36 years old. I was 7 at the time, and he died from complications from brain surgery. It wasn't the same type of tumor that I had, and his was actually in the brain tissue. And also, this was in the he was experiencing this in the late 60s, early 70s. So medical advances hadn't come along to where they are now. And although he survived the surgery and the but through the complications in surgery, he passed away. So it was really as quick as that night in the hospital after being told that they couldn't restore my sight, that you could go in many different directions at that point. And one of the key things I did was go there and think about it. And then you put it in that context, losing sight is somewhat trivial. It's like, I didn't know anything about blindness. I never had any friends that were blind. I've seen them on the streets. My mom is a musician. She would have a piano tuner come to the house that was blind. And she worked with a singer that was blind. But those were all sort of tangential, distant people that I didn't have any direct interface with. So I really just had no experience and didn't know what to think, with the exception that I knew that there were people out there coping with it, living successful, meaningful, engaged lives. And I just needed to figure out what I needed to learn.
You know, one of the things that was bouncing around your head during those early days of losing your sight was, how were you going to respond to this challenge in front of your son? Yeah. Tell us about that and what your concern was.
Well, it was tough. First, we didn't want to freak him out as I was going in for surgery. It's difficult to know how much to tell a young child going in. And we were pretty confident and optimistic about the surgery and the medical staff and surgeon. So we just didn't, let's just keep it kind of low key and see how it goes. And so when I lost my sight, then we had to start dealing with it. And he had to eventually come into the hospital and see me with my head all bandaged up and not able to see. And not that you could really tell the difference just laying there. It's like, because people remark that it's kind of unnerving because my eyes are perfectly normal.
Mm-hmm.
I engage, really lock on for eye contact.
Mm-hmm.
And so visually, you wouldn't necessarily think, especially if I'm stationary, that I'm blind. So anyway, just had normal conversations with him and started joking around as we always would. We always had a laugh together and had a good time. So I'm in the hospital, I'm cracking jokes, having fun, and just trying to keep him comfortable and really tried to continue doing that with him. And we really shared a lot of the training and learning. And he was so fascinated by all the different things I was learning, the different technologies.
Hmm.
He would walk with me when I'm going out for a walk with my cane. And so there's, he would even grab a cane with me, an extra cane, and he'd come along behind me. And he, one hand, I think he was trying to imagine what it was. And others just being part of it and being there with me. And we just had a fun time going through that together.
Chris Downey is the featured guest at Illuminate, a night benefiting Children's Center for the Visually Impaired on Thursday at the Abbott. That's at 1901 Cherry Street in Kansas City. You can find more information at ccvi.org. That's Children's Center for the Visually Impaired, ccvi.org. I really was struck, Chris, you and your son found a way to continue playing baseball together. How did you do that?
It was sort of on a fluke and a moment's notice. We were trying to decide what to do for Father's Day, and my wife was suggesting a number of things, and I was like, no, no, no. And finally I said, and she said, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want to play baseball. So my son, I could hear him pop up in his chair, and within 30 minutes, we were headed out the door. She drove us out to the ballpark and left us there. And it, actually, we might even walked up there. And we walked out on the field. There were people playing soccer, carrying on. And he and I walked out. I was with my cane carrying a bucket of balls. And he had his batting bag. And we set up shop. And we just started by... Yeah, his favorite position was first base. And being a 10-year-old first baseman, one thing is for sure is not every ball is coming to you just right.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, this is perfect. So you're going to practice playing first baseman. You're going to get on the first base. And you call out to me so I hear where you are, and I'm going to throw to you. and you can just keep reinforcing it. And, you know, if you got to reach, that's your job as a first baseman.
Yeah. I bet he has to reach a little bit now and then, right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So then we built from there and even got to the point where I would do like this coach toss from the sitting on the bucket, just separated from him for a few feet, and I just tossed the ball up and he did hit it away.
Oh, that's great.
I could hit to him. I could just drop and hit it to him if he's out in the field. I could throw it to him out in the outfield. So it's more of what we have quickly embraced was, and it's sort of the key, is finding ways to find yes as opposed to no.
Yeah.
It's so easy to say no, you can't do that.
Yes.
And it's a lot more fun, a lot more creative to say, okay, well then, how can we do that?
So. Chris Downey is my guest. He is remarkable for a whole host of reasons, including the fact that he is a blind architect. He'll be in town on Thursday evening at the Abbott, a benefit for the Children's Center for the Visually Impaired. More information, ccvi.org. You know, you were told pretty quickly that you, after you lost your sight, Chris, that you could no longer be an architect. What happened there? And obviously you responded to the contrary there.
Yeah. Well, it was actually within 6 hours of being told that they couldn't restore my sight. I was visited by a social worker there in the hospital who, in reading the chart, read that I was an architect. I said, oh, I see you're an architect. We can talk about career alternatives. I was like, wow. Yeah. You know, I hadn't even been 6 hours.
Yes.
I hadn't processed it yet. And already sort of expectations were being built. And quite frankly, expectations, opportunity, sort of the view of the future was radically changing. And you could really, it was striking to experience it.
So people really wonder, how do you manage, Chris? Yeah. How do you do it?
Well, I eventually came to realize the way of thinking, I think about it now, is, you know, the creative process, the design process, it's intellectual. You know, if you draw with a pencil, your pencil just doesn't magically know how to draw. It's your brain directing it around, driving the pencil. And everything you draw means something, whether you're using a pencil or clicking on a mouse in a computer or building a model. It's like your mind is what's really in play. And then you use all these other tools as ways to express, develop, and push on it and communicate it. So it basically came down to a tool problem. I just needed new tools. You know, I had been sufficiently trained. I had 20 years of experience in architecture, 2 degrees, you know, undergraduate degree and a master's degree in architecture, lots of experience. So I was in a bit of a sweet spot being at the age of 45 with all the technology that we have available to us today, being in a community that was really supportive, and quite frankly, in an office environment that was very supportive and optimistic about the prospects of finding ways of value to work within the profession and to bring something unique to it. So that really became the focus, getting the right tools. And so that's easily said than done.
But one thing you use is something called embossed architectural drawings. So you're reading drawings like you're reading Braille, like you're reading text, right?
Well, yeah, it's basically it's an embossing printer that the printer driver just converts the line work that you would see on the computer into a tactile line as it embosses the paper. And there's no conversion. It just happens through the magic of the printer driver. And it's the same sort of thing that people would do to share files anyway and share drawings, create a PDF and send it off. So it's pretty simple, pretty direct. I drive the printer myself.
Right.
I load up all the paper and deal with it all. And it's a large format embossing printer. So it's a larger, I'd like it to be a little larger, but it still gives me enough size to work with.
Because right.
One thing that's different, when you read a drawing through touch, you need a little bit more space around the lines and things to be able to discern one thing from another.
Let me just point out again that Chris is a featured guest at Illuminate, a night benefiting Children's Center for the Visually Impaired Thursday. More information, ccvi.org. Chris, I could talk longer, but I got a scoop. You've been a great guest. Thanks for taking some time.
Well, thanks so much, Dave.
You bet.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Good luck to you, Chris.
All right. Thanks.
Again, that's Chris Downey. Tomorrow on the show, some of the new and returning members of the Kansas City Public School Board will ask what's in store for Kansas City Public Schools. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.